When I was your age, for those that were are heading out to have fun, I would do something when I broke something in my house. And I don't know if you've ever done this, where you've broke something and you try to piece it all back together so that one of your siblings or brothers or sisters came along and they like touched it, you'd be like, ha ha, you broke it. You know, of course they knew that they didn't break it because they barely touched it. And so it all points back to the one that is responsible. Usually it was the one that called out the foul, you know. And so that happens. Maybe that's been a part of your life story. Maybe you did the same thing, you know. Maybe it was a brother or sister. Or maybe it was a husband or a wife. I don't know. It's harder to push the blame off there because they know exactly what's going on. But I want to tell you what about something that happened to me yesterday. I had to work at a job in the morning, so I'm going to this new house, and I go into this living room. I'm a window cleaner, for those that don't know. So I have to get up to windows, but sometimes people have their rooms organized in a way that makes it difficult, right? So there's this couch in the way of the window, and there's end tables on the couch, and I don't want to clean a window over the couch, and so I'm moving stuff around just so that I can get access to the window. But also, there's nice things on this end table. And I think to myself, I don't want to break this. So I'm going to set it over here. And so I set this vase. It was made out of clay, and it was it had a face. It was pretty amazing. And it was mostly just a vase, and then this face kind of emerged out of it. So I set it aside. I don't want to break that. I'm going to set this down over here out of the way, so I don't want to break that. And I get it all situated, and I go get my mop and squeegee, and I put it in my little bucket on a belt, and I walk over there, and as I'm walking by that vase, the squeegee handle goes pop and knocked over the vase. Like it goes crashing down, it breaks into two chunks. Thankfully, it was not a million shards, but just a few. I'm like, oh, I don't want to deal with this. So what I did is I went and got some super glue. Yes, Zach has done this before, right? And, like, I put it together, glue it back up, and it looks almost as good as new. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, maybe I won't even have to tell the client. I took responsibility for my action. I did it. Well, my squeegee did it, technically. So it wasn't even me. But I took responsibility. I fixed it. Everything looks good. You can't even notice. Well, you kind of notice the crack, but the way that the vase is positioned, it's away from anyone. So I'm thinking I'm basically in the clear. But I'm still I've been working on this message, and so I'm like, the Lord is kind of working over some of the content of the message, and then I'm thinking, first of all, I want to build a good relationship with this client. You know, if you're in an industry where the benefit of having return business helps you, then, well, it's important to maintain good relationships there. And so I was thinking through that, and I thought, if she finds out that it's broken and then she asks me, I have to tell her the truth, right? But if she doesn't, then I'm fine. But after a while, I thought, you know, I just need to tell her. And so I walk into the room, ma'am, I need to show you something. I kind of fixed it, but if it needs to be replaced, I'll replace it. Whatever the cost, doesn't matter. It's just like, oh, that's fine. You know, which was totally good. But what happened was, I was thinking through this message about just being above reproach, is that oftentimes we think that we can fix our own messes, or as a little kid, we construct the whatever thing we broke so that, okay, now I'm good and I'm above reproach, you know. But what happens is actually, we're actually taking the shame and the guilt of that action, and we're trying to stuff it down, right? We're trying to get distance from it, but the reality is that it's going to come back and haunt us. For me, yesterday, what could have happened, and even as I was thinking through, is that the consequence of me breaking it and confessing to her is, well, I might have to pay for it. But the relationship is still intact. Now, the consequence of me not telling her, of me just walking away thinking she'll never know, which may have been the case, she would never know. But if she finds out and thinks, the only other person that's been in this room was the window washer. And so then she would either, one, ask me and then find out that I'd tried to cover it up. And that has a way of fragmenting our relationships. And part of being a person above reproach is living in such a way, not that we step over people and we break things, because those things are going to happen. But it's to conduct yourself and live in such a way that when those things do happen, that you're responding in the correct way, right? That you're honest with people, that you confess your sin, that you repent, right? Now, I can confess the sin of a broken vase. I can't fully repent, right? I'll do my best not to break another vase. There may have been another time that I broke someone else's little artifact. That was a little more expensive. But I told her, right? And so there's ways in which you try to mitigate against that, but sometimes you just can't help it. But there are things in life that you can help. And oftentimes what happens is we run headlong into something that's going to cause brokenness all around. We run headlong into something just because, well, I want to. I desire it. That's a good choice. And we live in that moment. We live in that little sphere, and we just basically are like the bowl in the china shop, breaking everything that's there. I want to tell you a story about a man that was, well, he's talked about in the scripture as being a man after God's own heart. Okay? And that's not just a sugar coating of something, right? It's actually something that is said of this man, David. But David made an egregious mistake. And it all starts because he put himself in a situation that he was not where he should have been. You know, now, as some of you have known, we've been working through 2 Samuel, and so we've been learning about the life of King David. And we know from before 2 Samuel comes 1 Samuel, and that's where David is, Saul becomes king, and then he gets rejected by God eventually, but he's gonna finish up his reign. And God has already declared David as the new king. He's been anointed, he's been declared. But now David is in that period of his life where he's being forged into the person that he needs to be. Right? And so God shaped and trained David when he was a shepherd, as he was taking care of the flock, where he was taking care of his father's sheep, and doing whatever was necessary to protect them. And in some ways, that prepared him to be the shepherd of the nation of Israel. So as he was a young man, he took responsibility, and he worked a job. And then as he grew into an older man, this faithfulness and this competence here actually developed him and forged him into the man he was going to be here, where he would stand up for his people, where he would protect the nation of Israel, where he would make decisions that would impact them in a good way. Although, as we'll see in the 11th chapter of 2 Samuel, and really the challenge for us from David's example is that we need to learn to live above reproach. There are consequences when we don't. Now, there are consequences when we just fail, when we do things accidentally, that they weren't intentional. Right? When you say something to your wife and you didn't think it would have that impact, right? You just thought, well, it's just a fact. I didn't realize, or you respond in a different way to your husband or to your children. Maybe you say something to try to encourage them to be a better athlete, but the truth is they don't really care about that sport. They just want to please you, and this sport isn't pleasing you because they're not doing well, right? And studies have shown too that oftentimes the reason why kids they drop out of sports later on in high school isn't because of the sport. It's because of the ride home. What is being said? How are those children being encouraged? How is that sheep being encouraged and protected and pushed to the next level, whatever it may be? Now, David learned a few things as a shepherd, and then he was able to translate that into being the shepherd of God's people, but there was this long period of time in between in which David still had a lot to learn, and he was being forged. And as a man after God's own heart and a man of honor, so much of his heart and honor shaped all the ways that he interacted, how he protected even Saul, the king who was after his life, and then as he ran away and as he protected certain lands, and even as an army, when armies would roam, when they would roam, usually because they had the might, they would take the things that they wanted, right? So they would show up at a field or at a farm and be like, well, we got all these men. They need food. You have food. We have swords. Would you like a little exchange? Or maybe you can just give it to us and we'll go on our way. And, but for David, he didn't do that because he was a man of honor. He was a man after God's own heart. And so there was this sense in which all throughout his life he lived in it. And there were all those men that were under him in that context, learned from him. They learned the type of man he was. And Uriah the Hittite was probably in that group of men. He was a mercenary. He wasn't from the Hebrews or from Israel. But he came alongside. And so he was fighting with the army of Israel, and most likely was connected to David from that time before. Because this is early on in his reign when we get to this portion of the story. And so a lot of things have happened, but David has been tested. He's been revealing the type of character that he had. And we get to chapter 11. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab. Now, before I get there, I want to talk a little bit about a few things. Because part of what David does, and we'll have to back up. Sorry about that, Elizabeth. Let's understand what reproach is. Reproach is something that merits blame, rebuke, or disgrace. All right? When I broke that vase, had I not told her, and then she found out, that would have been a reproach. I would have merited blame. I would have merited rebuke. I would have merited disgrace. So to be above reproach is to actually be blameless and beyond criticism. Okay, so you live in such a way that it doesn't merit those other things. And for all of David's life, he had lived with courage, he had lived with honor, he had lived above reproach. Anytime Saul accused him of something, well, David was blameless. Right? He was like Teflon, he just slid off. He wasn't like another one of our leaders today who, well, the mud doesn't stick because there's a lot of mud, right? And part of the challenge as believers is that we recognize that there's more to the position of power and honor than just getting the job done. Right? Who our leaders are as people affects and impacts us as a nation. Who the people are and the character of the people that we lift up in whatever ways we lift them up will impact us as people. So for many of you who have sons, your sons are going to lift up you just because you're their father. And so the ways that you respond to situations, how you interact with your wife, how you deal with life is going to impact and actually influence them in a powerful way. In Proverbs 14:32, this would be the son of King David writing this years after that, of course. And he says this, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Why? Because sin places us into that context where we merit or we deserve rebuke, we deserve blame, right? And so part of the encouragement as a people is, how do I live in a righteous way? How do I live in a way that is going to be clean of that, free of that? Even as I struggle through life, even as I struggle through and stumble through the things that I wish I had victory for and the things that you wish you had victory for and victory against, how do we find righteousness? How do we find that place where even our life would be exalted? Right? If your life story is written down just like David's was in the Bible, by an all-knowing, omniscient source, and basically all of your warts and all of your faults are just laid bare, what would it read? How would it read? Because in this moment, we find out in chapter 11, David actually lives contrary to his character. He lives contrary to the type of person he had always been and continued to be, and then all of a sudden, a misstep. All of a sudden, instead of above reproach, well, he messes up royally. 2 Samuel 11, verse 1. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, which is the capital city there. But David remained at Jerusalem. Well, one of the things we note is that the Israelites, they're attacking the Ammonites and they're attacking the capital. They're laying siege. Why? Well, if you do a little research or just read the chapter that came right before chapter 11, you'll find out that the king of the Ammonites had died and his son took power, which is normally how things happen. Well, apparently, and most likely, David, as he was running away from Saul, took refuge with the king of the Ammonites. And so there was some form of a relationship. And so when the father died, David sent a bunch of an envoy, basically, a bunch of people to go mourn and to just give consolation of that, of the grief. Well, the son of the king didn't interpret that as an act of kindness, but he interpreted it as an act of war. They're coming to scope us out. They're coming to check us out. So instead of actually just turning them away and saying, no, we don't want you in our land, you need to go home. This son decided to, well, to do something that was, let's say, below reproach, right? And if you're familiar with the story, this is what he did. He took the guys that had, that David had sent as a way of saying, hey, and probably brought gifts as well. You know, we grieve with you. Your father was helpful to me. That type of thing. What the son did is he shaved their beards in half. That wasn't like a top hat. It, right down the side, just shaved the beard off, half of it, right? And in those days, at that time, a beard was a sense of honor. You were a man if you had a beard, right? Little boys, well, they couldn't grow beards yet, right? So shaved off half of their beards and then cut half of their robes. But it wasn't this way. Half of their robes off and sent them back. Right? So there's this immense disgrace and this reproach that he was actually placing upon those men. And David, when he found out, he said, guys, you need to stay at Jericho until your beards grow out and we'll get you some more clothes. All right. Because I don't want you coming here. All right. All right. Tempting all the ladies. Don't do it. All right. So part of, you know, part of what David did as a response was he tried to cover that shame. They would have had, they would have carried shame being in the condition they were at. So he was protecting even those men. But that would basically start a war, right? Well, that's what happens when you do things like that in vile and disgusting ways to people that don't deserve it. And so the Ammonites had to actually, you know, elicit other help because Israel was a lot stronger than the Ammonites. And so they paid a hefty price to include some other kings, and there was this great battle, and there was victory. And that happened the season before, you know, the season of battle. And so the spring comes along again this year. Well, we haven't actually dealt with the Ammonites, and so we're going to deal with the Ammonites because of what they did, and we will conquer them. And so that's why they laid siege to Kaaba, and that's why they were attacking. That's where it war. But there's no reason why David would have stayed home. There's no reason at all. He usually was with his men, fighting with his men. He was a warrior. There's a reason why they said he killed his 10,000s. And probably a reason why Saul didn't, because Saul probably wasn't in the middle of the battle with his men like David was. But not on this occasion, David decides, for some reason, we don't know, but he decides, hey, guys, I'm just not feeling it. I'm going to stay in my castle. I mean, I'm going to stay in my palace. And I'm going to just kind of basically just kind of chill. You know, I've got some social media I've got to deal with. I've got some other responsibilities that aren't quite responsible, but that's what I'm going to do. And we'll see that he gets into some significant trouble. But David remains home. One of the things when you think about learning to be above reproach is that you have to guard yourself. You have to guard yourself from acting beneath yourself. Because there's that tendency in all of us. We even sang a song about being prone to wander. Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God. There's this tendency within us, and I don't know why. And part of it might be that God allows it so that we continue to forge in us the character of Christ, that as we wrestle with the struggles and the things that we want victory in, that we will find victory, and in that process we'll become stronger. And so there's a reason why God allows those temptations in our life. And for David, he had acted with nobility throughout his life. But in this moment, he puts himself in a place where he is not guarding himself from acting beneath his nobility. Now, there's a familiar verse that goes like this, Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And usually we think of it as one complete thought, but it's actually a thought inside of a much larger truth. But when we think about that thought, oftentimes, and as I was growing up, and this is true, is that my sin causes me to fall short of God's glory. I can't go to heaven because of my sin. God is holy, and sin doesn't, God can't allow sin into his presence. Or maybe more accurately, if sin steps into his presence, it's immediately done. Right? We know that even with Moses, where God said, "Yeah, if you see me in all my glory, you can't handle it. You'll die." You know, and so maybe that's that sense, and I've always understood it to be that way. That I'm falling short of God's glory because of my imperfection. But I want you to think about this other truth, is that each one of us were made in the image of God. And so to some degree, we reflect God's glory. I don't know what that is. We reflect Him. There's characteristics that we can reflect, and we reflect them well, whether it's love or patience or kindness. Sometimes we reflect anger, right? Although oftentimes that's not in the way that God reveals His anger, right? But there are occasions where we reflect Him and we show something of Him. Part of the consequence of sin is that as people, we aren't who we want, we aren't what God intended for us to be. And maybe a little bit is revealed when Moses comes off of the mountain and he's glowing. Or when Moses came out of the tent of meeting because he would meet with God, God's presence would descend and he would meet with God. And when he came out, he'd be glowing. And they put a veil over his head because he wanted the people of Israel to not see that glory fade away. Because as you distance yourself from God, the person that you were made to be begins to fade away. The nobility that is a part of and woven into the fabric of who we are fades away. If we don't guard ourselves against that, as I move to pursue my own desires and am I lured by and enticed by sin, is that I'm moving away from God and I'm becoming more diminished. I'm not the person that God meant for me to be, and I'm not the person God saved me to be. Right? God has redeemed us. For those that have placed their faith in Christ, God has dealt with that sin. So in the spring of that year, the kings went off. David stayed behind. He wasn't guarding himself. Verse 2. It happens late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking along the roof of the king's house, and he saw from the roof a woman bathing. And she was very beautiful. So in the cool of the day, he's walking around. He's just checking the sights, looking at the land. And then he sees something that doesn't belong to him. But at that time, he doesn't know. But she still doesn't belong to him. He's a married man. Actually, it's several times over. Right? And so there's a sense in which he needs to be honorable and turn away. But you know, even as it describes, he sees her, instead of turning away, he sees how very beautiful she was. You see, there's this tendency when we're tempted to think that the temptation is bad. No, the temptation is just around us. It's how you respond and how I respond to temptation will reveal whether or not you and I are guarding ourselves from acting beneath our nobility. In that moment, he took a second glance. And then maybe a longer glance. There are three phases to temptation. As it says, it reveals in James, the three phases are this. There's the desire. We all have desires. So there's this desire. But then number two is that leads to sin. And then the third phase is death. Those are the three phases of temptation. As James says in chapter 1, verse 14 and 15 of his letter, but each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. You see, there are consequences to not the desire that we have. It's the desire that I have that's improperly pursued. There's a consequence to that. I desire to have more money. Just so that life is, you know, so I don't have to manage it as well, right? So I can be lazy, or so I can have the things that I want, so I can get the upgraded iPhone, right? I got an older one, right? And it's getting a little kludgy, so I can have a better, fill in the blank, right? So that desire is questionable. If I love money more than anything, that becomes the root of all evil, but, you know, we should pursue money to provide for the things, the people that we care about, and the things that we want to accomplish in life. And so the desire isn't bad. It's then, how do I pursue that desire? Because then that pursuit can turn into sin, and that pursuit, if I continue to pursue it in all the wrong ways, will end up in my own death. Now, it might be the death of a life that I wanted to live because I'm stuck behind prison. It might be the death of the relationships that I wanted because those friendships don't trust me anymore. Why? Because I took from them or whatever it might be. And I have friends that are like that, that I've invited to my house. They have stayed at my house all by themselves because I trusted them, and then stuff shows up missing. And after a while, that builds up, and then pretty soon as that loss builds up, that friendship becomes lost. And maybe some of you have those friendships or have had those friendships where eventually you say, I got to cut ties because you're not healthy, because I can't trust you. See, desire leads to sin, and sin eventually leads to death. Death of dreams, death of relationships, death of potential. Guard yourself. You see, you can't always control your circumstances. Sometimes you're just caught up in the moment. You're caught up in this situation, and so you cannot control that. You have a brother or sister that constantly pushes your buttons, and they know what buttons to press. Or it's your spouse, or it's your mother or your father, right? They know how to get you to respond. You can't control the situations that surround you, but you can control your responses. You are always responsible for your reaction to the circumstances. You see, David, when he was sitting on top of his palace, looking out over things, and he saw the woman bathing, he could have walked away. He could have turned his eyes. He could have dignified her by not staring and objectifying her. But that's what he did. He got caught up in his desires were enticed, and that gave birth to sin. And so we see in verses 3, 4, and 5 kind of this progression of sin as it lives out with, as it works itself out with David. And David sent. I want you to circle the word sent. Circle the word inquired. So he sent some of his messengers and inquired about the woman. He wanted to find out what her state was. Is she single? Is she married? And one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Okay, so then stage 2. So David sent messengers and took her. He inquired about her. Now he takes her. And she came to him, and because he's the king, so she's the subject. She has to obey. We have a hashtag Me Too moment right here. And it's a man who is known for being a man after God's own heart. But in that moment, he wasn't where he should have been. He should have been fighting with his men, but no, he's on top of his palace. And in that moment, he doesn't choose the high road. He doesn't choose to respond to the temptation in a proper way and turn and avert his eyes. He clicks the button again. And he clicks it again. And he clicks it again, right? So the second thing he does is he takes her. And then you have the final thing. And this is the response to the act, is 2 Samuel 11:5. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I'm pregnant. You see, we find out in verse 4 that she had just been purifying herself of uncleanness. And so, in many ways, that indicates that she wasn't pregnant from Uriah, who had just gone off to battle. So now David is in a little bit of a bind, or a big bind. You see, what happens is that when we don't guard ourselves from acting below our nobility, when we condescend and when we descend into that level of life, sometimes we don't see the consequences because we're so focused on the reward of getting the thing that I want. David wanted her. So he used his power, and she responded. Now, she could have responded in the right way too. She's not guilty. I'm sorry, she's not innocent of it, excuse me. But she's not as guilty as David. And that's important to note. David was the one in power and he was abusing it. And then finally, just be reminded that you will be held responsible for your actions. And that reminder is a longer view of life. This longer view of, well, what happens if this happens? Yeah, I fixed the vase. She won't notice, most likely. But what happens if she does notice? Or even this. What happens if she never notices, but I always know that I never told her? That I deceived someone that I barely knew. And I go to her house every year or twice a year and clean her windows. Think about that. Sometimes we don't think about the effect of sin on our spirit and how it affects us on the inside. Because we just want to fulfill whatever it is on the outside. And David was in that space and in that place. Number two, resist covering up your sin by increasing sin. Isn't there a tendency if you get caught in a lie or get caught doing something is that it leads to another lie and another lie? Or one sin leads to another sin, leads to another sin, and this is what's happening with David. Is that once we go down, sometimes we find ourselves going further down the rabbit hole. Further down to a place that we didn't imagine we could be. And for David, this is pretty dark. Because this is a guy that he did battle with. This is a guy that he fought alongside. This was a brother in arms. And he did this to his wife. But then what we'll see is the sin gets worse than you can imagine. Now, why do we have a need to have others think better of us than we actually need, or than we actually are? Why do I have that need inside to portray myself as someone that I'm not so that you think that I'm a better person than I am? Because there's that longing inside of a lot of us. Now, some of us are just the opposite, and I have relatives that are that way. They're like, this is who I am, you know? And we're like, yeah, stay away. Keep your distance from Uncle so-and-so, right? Because, well, he just is rough. You know, you have to know going in. You give him a hug and love him, but then distance, just for health reasons. But, you know, how many of us, though, tend to, we have this longing inside of us to portray ourselves or to want others to think more highly of us than we ought? And there can be a negative reason, a sinful reason, but there's also, and I think this is what I'd like to focus on, God made us to long to be better than who we are, right? Because each one of you sitting in your chair, you know that you could have done better at this or that. You could have responded better in this way. And most of the time we just stuff it down, but we are aware of that. And we long to do better. We want to do better, especially for those people that we love. Is that I don't want to do this. I don't want to go down that road. I don't want to ignore him. I don't want to speak in this way. But I find myself doing that. And there's that constant nagging of, actually, I want to be a better person. And as God and Christ redeems us, is that he's empowering us and giving us that ability to, I think, to be able to begin to move forward in a positive way. For him to shape in our lives the type of people that we want to be. But when I do find myself in sin, there is that tendency, and I need to resist it, to increase the sin. See, for David, he realized he was in a bind because, well, his action is going to be found out in about 9 months. And Uriah the Hittite is still at war, right? And they're going to be at battle for a while. We don't know how long, but it's going to be a little bit longer. And then they have to travel back, so it's going to be longer still. And then questions are going to start to surface. Why is Bathsheba pregnant? Because Uriah was off to battle, right? And so he realizes, okay, I've got to solve this problem. I'm going to do the first. There's kind of three phases to the way that David schemes or the way that he solves his problem. And we'll start off with in 2 Samuel 11:6-7. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. Now Uriah came to him. David asked how Joab was doing, how the people are doing, how's the war going on. A lot of small talk. I want some details. I don't want you to figure out why I actually brought you back from the battle, so we're going to talk about other things. I'm going to shoot the breeze. I'm going to find out some specifics. But okay, thank you for giving me an update. You probably wonder, or Uriah was probably wondering, why did King David bring me? He could get this information from any. I'm one of his warriors. I've done battle with him. I need to be on the battlefront. Why am I being pulled off? You know, and so you kind of begin to see that there's a little bit more to the story, and David is already trying to solve the problem. And his scheme has three phases. The first would be encouraging. The second would be manipulating. And then the third phase would be murdering. Now, David doesn't think through those three phases. This is the progression of the sin. The first is to encourage Uriah. Okay, I need to get Uriah back to the home so that he could then spend time with his wife, and then no one will know. Right? It'll be covered up. And so he does that. Well, Uriah is a man of honor. See, oftentimes what happens is we portray our dishonorable intentions on people that are honorable. There are times in which we do that, and David was longing for Uriah to take advantage of a little bit of R&R from the war, spend time with his wife, have relations, and then no one would know. Except for Uriah is a man of honor, who had actually fought battles with David as a man of honor. So he learned from his leader, and we see in the next verses, verse 8 through 10, then David says to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. And Uriah went down to the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants. David had just told him, go home, wash your feet, get comfortable with your beautiful wife. She's very beautiful. You can do that. Go ahead. And he's like, nope. We're at war. And so David inquires about it. Why did you not go down to his house? And David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? You could have rested there. Next to your very beautiful wife. You see, oftentimes honorable people that stand next to dishonorable people creates conflict just because they're present. Just because they're standing by, and it's the conflict happens because people that live below reproach don't like it when other people are living at this level, and they'll want to pull them down. And they might do it with encouragement, they might do it in other ways, and we'll get there. You see, worldly people will encourage you to act beneath your honor. They will encourage you to act in a way that they're acting. Oh no, everyone's doing it, it's okay, this is just what we do. They will encourage you, you know, everyone's wearing hats in church, you know, doesn't matter, I do it sometimes. But I want to honor those people that are older, that are a part of the military, that really believe that that's a sign of respect. And so I take off my hat in church for them. You know, and that's significant. Now, worldly people, they will encourage you. They want to bring you along. They want to entice. See, that's one way that they deal with the blame and the rebuke and the shame that's inside. If I get everyone to do it, then we're all the same, right? If I'm acting like an animal, then, well, I just get other people to act like an animal, and then that's okay, because that's now we can define humanity as animals. We just do whatever we feel like doing, right? Well, that's not what God made us to be. You know, the other side of it is sometimes what can happen is that we try to act like angels too. And we have to be careful because we're trying to better ourselves and encourage as a community to encourage one another to be better, to grow in Christ, to become more like Christ. But be careful because we're not perfect. We're going to fail. We're not angels. Okay? But we're not animals. And it's important to know that. But worldly people will want to encourage you to do the thing that they want you to do to alleviate some of their own shame and guilt. Uriah said to David, the Ark of Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in an open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live, and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. See, he was a man of honor and conviction. He had already decided that he wasn't going to act beneath his nobility. And so that, in turn, affects how he's going to act in this moment, which then causes King David to react. If I can't encourage him to do the thing that I want, I will manipulate him. And so we find out in the text, he said, well, okay, stay another night, Uriah, and we're going to have a party. I'm going to give you a lot of food and a lot of wine and get you drunk and then send you out to your house. Okay, now that you're plastered and your resolve is weakened, I'm going to send you home. Please, God, let him sleep with his wife. You know, sometimes we do that. We get caught in our own sin and then we're asking God to bail us out. But God already said, I don't want you to do this. You shouldn't do that. You should be self-controlled. Because when you're not, this is going to have this impact. Or just trust me, you won't know the impact, but you're not going to like it. And then we do it, and we get caught in a sin, and then we think, I don't like these consequences. I wish I didn't have it. And then we pray to God, and God's like, that's a part of the process. We didn't know we were going to have a baby. I think you did, right? I think David and Bathsheba kind of knew that's kind of what happens. They're not new, they're not new to that. So worldly people will manipulate you to live the way they live. They will try to manipulate you. And they'll have a lot of good reasons. And so David, well, he tries the manipulating tactic. And we find out that at the end, he makes him drunk. And in the evening, he went down out to lie on his couch with the servants of his Lord. But he did not go down to his house. You see, honorable people who live out their convictions, not just for the sake of others. Sometimes you might do this, or I've done this, where I live in a certain way because I know that's the conviction of other people. Right? It's not my conviction. I just shared with you, sometimes I wear a hat inside. Even when the roof is covering my head, I have to put a cover over my head. Right? Well, I take it off because of someone else's convictions, someone else's standards. Sometimes we live and we portray ourselves for other people's standards instead of our own. But Uriah, his standard of honor and conviction of staying away from his wife is going to stay true even when he's drunk, even when his will has been affected by alcohol. If that doesn't work, then oftentimes worldly people will just want you out of the picture. It's like, well, if you keep making me feel this way about the life choices that I made, then I just don't want to know you. If you can't affirm the decisions that I have made and agree with my position, then I'm going to unfriend you. Right? Instead of, why can't we be friends even if you have a different position? I still think you have value. I still love you. I just don't agree with that. And you might have a lot of reasons for it, and they might have a lot of reasons on their side. But there are occasions where people, and this is oftentimes, and I think it's more a sense of worldliness, is that there's this, I'm going to jettison the relationship because it's hard. I'm going to jettison this relationship because they don't believe exactly what I believe. And sometimes pastors do this too. If you don't believe what I believe about this really strange, unique system of theology, not the basics, but some, we can get pretty fine-tuned. And then because we're so fine-tuned, we think, oh, everyone's got to agree with me. And if they don't agree with me, they're against me. That isn't the case. But worldliness and worldly people will do that. They'll try to take you out of the picture because their conscience will speak to them every time you're around. And so David decides, this is my last choice. I've got to take Uriah out of the picture. I've got to take him out. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. I want you to think about that for a second. David is writing a letter signing the death of one of his men that he fought beside and having that man carry that letter to the general. That's pretty low. I mean, that's really, really low. But it all started because when he was standing on his palace, he decided to go low when he should have gone high. He decided to act beneath his own dignity. And that began a process of sin impacting not just his life, but the life of Bathsheba and the life of Uriah. You see, the progression and the impact of sin is farther reaching than we can ever imagine. Oftentimes we just look at the short-term benefits. Or we just think, I'm going to do this because I want to do it. There are consequences to that. And in the letter he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him, that he may be struck down and die. Now, Joab does it differently if you read the rest of the story. He's like, that's going to look really bad. I'm going to have to tell a bunch of guys. Okay, we're going to go up, and then right as we start fighting, we're all backing off, except for leave Uriah there. Because now there's more people in the conspiracy, right? And Joab's a little bit smarter than the guy named King David, right? In that moment, because King David just wants to get rid of the problem. Joab's like, oh, that's going to make problems for me. So he allowed a bunch of people to die with Uriah. And that impacted even more people. Why? Because a king couldn't control himself. Number three, if we were to learn to be above reproach, you need to set your course away from this indignity. Seeing people as objects to be used and abused, that's not dignified. Set your course away from this. You see, Joab, as he's besieging it, he has to live out, he has to obey the king's command, or so he thinks. And so that impacts him. And Joab is besieging the city. He assigns Uriah to the place where he knew that there were valiant men on the other side. And the men of the city came out, fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah was in that number. And so then Joab informed David, and David, sigh of relief. Right? But you can imagine how that's going to impact him. And as it impacts us, the choices that we make that either just affect a person's life or even change the course of their life. Be careful. Live above reproach. Live in a way that's not beneath you. Don't allow one sin to turn into more sins that are deeper and darker. And then number three, set your course away from this way of life, this indignity. Because that's what low people do. That's what animals, that's what beasts do. They just treat people like objects on their way to the dreams and the goals that they want, not knowing that at the end of that goal is a real lonely life. Achieving that dream is not what it's meant, it's not what you think it is. And then at the end of this chapter, 26 and 27, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. See, there are things that we do that we think no one will know, that no one knows about, that we have covered up, or that our family helps us cover up, that God knows about, and does it please him or does it displease him? Oftentimes we don't realize the blessing and the benefit of having the smile of God on our life, of having his pleasure. And so we live and we kind of choose our own course instead of allowing him to guide our lives. The fourth and final point as the worship team comes to the front. I want us to think about this fourth way of learning to be above reproach. And number four is see how your actions impact others. See, to be above reproach is to actually have a bigger view of yourself and the impact of your actions on those people around you. See, in that moment when David was on top of the palace, he was thinking about himself only. He wasn't thinking about how it would impact the woman. He wasn't thinking about how that would impact her husband. He wasn't thinking about how that would impact the warriors around. that would have needlessly died. He was thinking about himself. Oftentimes in life, when I think about myself, it usually ends up with me living beneath myself and not accomplishing or not living up to that standard that even I have, which isn't even God's standard. The conscience in me is hopefully learning to become more attuned and like God's standard, which is revealed in his word. But until that day and until Christ comes, I'm still working towards that. In Psalm 51, David talks about this occasion, the impact of it. And he says these words, and I want you to think about them. For I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. He's constantly reminded of this act of sin. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. That's a hard verse because he's talking to God and he's saying, God, when I sinned there, I was sinning to you. You only. I'm like, you sinned against that woman. Hashtag me too. You sinned against her husband. Hashtag you're a murderer. You sinned against all the guys around him. Hashtag you're a conspirator. I mean, this is, you know, deep state stuff, if you could get even more political, right? I mean, it's pretty bad, and that's what kings did. But as godly people who have been given a chance to live at a higher level, and God has given us that power to live at a level that he wants us to live, to be the version of ourselves that's more like, most like Christ. I want to think about, we're not going to do the last verse, but in Philippians 2, 14 and 15, it says this, do all things without grumbling or disputing so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. We live with a world around us that is twisted and is messed up. And if we're honest, we're a little twisted and messed up as well. And by God's grace, he's beginning to straighten out those things that are crooked in us. And he's given us the power to do that. And he's given you the power to do that, to actually live above reproach, to face the battle that you face this week and find victory, to look at the struggle and know you don't have to succumb to that anymore, to be able to stand on top of your palace, whatever it is, if it's behind a keyboard or if it's in this situation or that situation, and find victory and do the right thing. And to live above reproach. To live blameless. Because that is the best way to live. It's in that way that you will appear as lights to the world. And they will see a better life. They will see joy that lasts. They will experience hope. And hopefully they will come to Christ. Because they will see a change in you that is different than what the world has to offer. Heavenly Father, I just thank you for today. I thank you that you have enabled us to live above reproach. To live in such a way that we would be strong and courageous. That we would honor you and honor those around us, that we would recognize how our actions impact those in this community, those in this city, those in this nation. So help us to be mindful of that. Help us to love our families as you have called us to love, and help us to live for you as you know will make life different and better. As the men come forward with the offering and as we give our gifts, I pray that you would just disminister, that you would encourage us this week and help us go in your strength. I pray this in your son's name. Amen.
Why don't you all stand? I wish I had known the message because I would have picked a different ending song. I tried to make a connection between it, but